Hello and welcome to the Get Started with Film Photography podcast. My name is Graham Young. In a previous episode, I talked about buying your first camera and what to look for. And then I did a four-part series on buying your first single-lens reflex camera. This is a similar series. This will be, I believe, a two-part series on buying your first rangefinder. So the first thing that I want to talk about is what a rangefinder is and how it is different from a single-lens reflex or an SLR. The first thing that we have to note in the difference between a rangefinder and a single-lens reflex is with the single-lens reflex, you are looking through the lens of the camera, whereas through a rangefinder, you are looking through a viewfinder that is separate from the lens. That viewfinder also has within it a double image patch. And usually it's right in the center. Usually it's a rectangle. Sometimes it's a diamond. But it is a patch right in the center. It's usually a slightly different color. Often it's a yellowish color. Sometimes it is a neutral color. Sometimes it is not a different color. But what it is it's a little mirror. And that mirror is being reflected over to another window that is a certain distance away from that first window. Now, that distance varies with different rangefinders. The theory is the longer the distance, the longer the base, the distance, the more accurate your rangefinder is. But we'll talk about that a little bit more. But what that is it's a little patch, and then it has another window. The patch that you're looking at is a reflection from that other window. And it's a translucent reflection. It's not fully there. It's we're only seeing about half of the image of that little patch. And the idea is we want to move the two patches, the two images within that patch is what I really should say. The two images within that patch, we want to move them over each other. When we have them moved over each other, then that means that the elements are in alignment. The lens is focused on what that object is. So that is the method of a rangefinder. Now, there are two different types of rangefinders. One of the types of rangefinders is coupled, the other is uncoupled. And of course, the more modern cameras are coupled, the older cameras are uncoupled. What coupled means is that if you move the patch so that it's in alignment, you're also moving the focus of that particular lens. If it is uncoupled, that means that you're matching up that patch and then you're looking at a dial that will tell you what that distance is. You transfer that number to the lens, and lenses have focusing scales on them. You move it to a point where the lens markings and the rangefinder markings are equal. If you get to that point, what you have is a focus. You are focusing the same distance away as what that rangefinder indicated that you're focusing. So that is a coupled rangefinder and an uncoupled rangefinder. We will talk about which ones are coupled and which ones are uncoupled. I would say that the vast majority of modern rangefinders, and modern, I'm going to say 1960 and after. So that would be the modern era of the rangefinder. A vast majority of those are coupled. If you go back previous, if you go back earlier, you will find uncoupled rangefinders. And in fact, you can find rangefinders that will fit in the accessory shoe of a camera. And the accessory shoe, we also refer to as the hot shoe or the flash shoe that's there on the top of the camera. Originally, that had no direct connection to a flash. It was just for whatever accessory you put on it. Most commonly, originally, that accessory was a rangefinder. Another difference between rangefinder cameras and single-lens reflex cameras is that almost every single-lens reflex camera has a focal plane shutter. And a focal plane shutter is a shutter that moves either horizontally or vertically just in front of the film, whereas many rangefinders, and in fact almost the whole set of rangefinders in the second half, the second episode of this two-episode series, almost all of them will have what we call a leaf shutter. And a leaf shutter sits within the lens. It sits either directly behind the last element of the lens, or it sits in between lens elements. And it opens up for a period of time, and then it closes down, and it is a circular opening. So it opens, closes. Both of those types of shutter systems have their advantages, and we'll talk about those a little bit later, specifically as we get closer to the second half, where I talk about travel and holiday rangefinders. Now, one thing, I'm going to just stop what I'm talking about. I just want to remind people, this is not a full and encyclopedic survey of all things rangefinder. This is a top-level surface skimming, and what I want to do is I want to give you guys the opportunity to go out and have a jumping off point and then explore further on your own. So if I skip over something that you know, don't worry. That's not because I don't know about it. Well, it may be because I don't know about it. It's not because it's not worthy. It's because I'm doing a very top level survey of this type of camera. So go out and feel free to explore further. There's much more information on everything that I cover out there on the internet. And if you are, you know, are stumped at all, give me a message. Send me a message. You can send me a voicemail message through the Anchor app, or, you know, you just have to download the Anchor app. It's free, and then send a little voice message through them. Or you can send me an email, or you can fill out the form on my website. All of that information is at the end of each episode. I want to say that it is kind of difficult to classify rangefinders for the first five decades of the 20th century, so the first half of the 20th century. And that's because rangefinders were very common across many different body types. You can buy 4x5 cameras that have rangefinders on them. You can buy little tiny travel cameras that have rangefinders on them. You can buy professional cameras. You can buy folding cameras. In the first half of the 20th century, any camera before about 1950, I'm going to say could be a rangefinder, but it's not the body style that we're talking about today. Now, I will go back into the 1930s when I start talking about the history of rangefinders. And there are some that have what we look at as a current rangefinder like body style. So there were medium format rangefinders all the way up into the 1980s or 1990s. There were folding rangefinders that were common both in 35mm and in 120 or even larger format, all the way up until the 1960s. So I want to say that we're not really looking at folding cameras. And folding cameras I will deal with in a future episode, and I'll talk all about the advantages of folding cameras, and I'll talk about the disadvantages of folding cameras. What we're looking for really is a rigid body and either an interchangeable lens or a fixed lens. And those really came about in the mid-1950s, even though they had earlier ancestors in the as far back as the 1920s, but we'll talk about them starting in the 1930s. There are many different body types that have rangefinders, as I've just alluded to. So there are many folding rangefinders. Then there are many folding cameras that are zone focus, and there are many folding cameras that are focus free. So that's an example of a body type and different focusing systems. What I'm going to really center on, of course, is the 35mm rangefinder, and it is the common one that is available today. We're going to also cover medium format rangefinders in a future episode, so look for those episodes. We'll talk about some early examples. We'll talk about some very early folding 35mm rangefinders, but we won't talk a lot about them. So I'm going to have to break this up into two parts, this episode up into two parts. The first part is going to be the professional cameras, and they are the interchangeable lens cameras. They had their heyday from really the 1950s through the end of the 1960s, but they were seen as early as 1930, and there were some models that were made as late as 2015. So it's quite a range of time. Now, the second part of this episode will be about holiday cameras, which are consumer cameras that were made from the 1950s to the 1980s. Really, the peak was probably the 1960s. They use the same rangefinder system as the professional interchangeable lens luxury rangefinders, but they had a fixed lens. That fixed lens was usually in a focal length from about 40 to 50 millimeters. So it was really on maybe the slightly wide and slightly tele side of normal. Now, there's a little bit of dispute in this. Some people say that the 50 millimeter lens or the 52 millimeter lens is the normal lens, meaning it is equal to what our eyesight is. If we open up an eye and we look through a lens with the other eye, some people think that 50 or 52 is about normal. From my eyesight, I think about 45, 43 to 45 is a normal view. And there are also some people who say that as wide as 40 is a normal view. I'm going to argue, since this is my experience and you may have a slightly different experience, my experience is 45. So I'm going to say that the normal view is 45. Most of the holiday cameras were a little bit wide on that. They were generally 38 really to about 45, though some of them were a little bit closer to 50 as well. What that means is that you're able to get in a little bit more in a frame. So like if you have a group of people that you're taking a picture of, it's very advantageous to have a wide angle lens. If you have a smartphone, which I'm going to assume that you do since you're listening to a podcast, if you have a smartphone, those cameras start out with a very wide angle lens at about a 28 millimeter equivalent lens so that you can get a bunch of stuff in. But then, of course, you can zoom in. But their native is that wide angle as opposed to a normal view because it's a camera that's really designed to take pictures of people. That's its advantage. That's its style. That's the idea of the slightly wide holiday rangefinder, but closer to normal also. Generally, these holiday cameras have a relatively fast lens, which means it's 2.8, f2.8 or below. And what I mean by below is below in number, 2.8 or wider. The fastest that I've seen on a fixed lens rangefinder, I think, is 1.7. Canon had a 1.7 Canonette. It's not uncommon to see a 1.8 or 1.9. And really, those apertures are so close to each other, they're meaningless in the difference for a camera. So if you're choosing a camera because that has a 1.7 versus a 1.9, that really is not a meaningful difference. These cameras, these holiday travel cameras that I'll talk about in part two of this episode, eventually morphed into the point-and-shoot cameras of the 1980s, 90s, and early 2000s. And really, they're the progenitors of the, you know, pocketable digital cameras that we had that have now been replaced by our phones. Besides the point-and-shoot cameras, these cameras were also displaced by the auto-everything SLRs of the late 1990s. This is because those cameras were really marketed at amateurs. They were marketed at people who didn't know a lot about photography, so you could set it to auto everything. Well, that's the pretty close to the same market that we get from that travel rangefinder. So the last travel rangefinders, I don't have a date, but I would be very surprised if any of them were made into the 1990s. There were certainly some that were made into the 1980s, but into the 1990s, they had already started morphing into that point-and-shoot camera, and they were also starting to get autofocus. I'm going to go ahead and take a break right now, and when we get back, I'm going to talk about the interchangeable lens luxury rangefinder market. Okay, so, you know, as I said, that this is going to be a two-part episode, this may actually need to be more parts than that. So I'm going to say in the first half, we're going to talk about these professional interchangeable lens rangefinder cameras. So let's go ahead and talk about those. Let's start off with the Leica thread mount. Now, the first Leica, the Leica 1, was a fixed lens camera. It did not have those interchangeable lenses. It had an uncoupled accessory rangefinder. Now, in 1930, they modified this fixed lens camera to accept these Leica thread mount lenses. And that Leica 1, the Leica 1 variant that had the Leica thread mount or the Leica screw mount, became an interchangeable lens rangefinder camera. Now, it was an uncoupled rangefinder. It did not have the built-in rangefinder. You needed to use a rangefinder in the accessory shoe, or you would do what we call zone focusing, which is look at the scene, decide how far away it is, turn that lens to how far away it is, and then just trust your eye to know the distance. Then the next model that Leica released in 1932 was called the Leica Standard. Now, it did not use a rangefinder at all. It was a viewfinder or zone focusing camera, but it was the first to use natively the Leica thread mount. Also in 1932, Leica released the Leica 2, which was the first Leica thread mount fully integrated coupled rangefinder camera. So the Leica 2 on, so from 1932 on, you could buy an interchangeable lens rangefinder that had that rangefinder coupled so that you would be able to look through the viewfinder and look through the, usually, in fact, actually, I believe that this one did not have an integrated rangefinder and viewfinder window. I'm going to go ahead and do a little bit of research on this because I am unsure. Okay, so I'm back. I did a really quick bit of research. This camera, the Leica 2, did not have an integrated viewfinder and rangefinder. What it had was a rangefinder, two rangefinder windows, and then in between it, they had a viewfinder window. So you would line up the rangefinder, then you would look through the viewfinder, and the viewfinder would be where you would frame the image. Now, often, once again, I have never used one of these cameras, but often in this situation, I have used other cameras with this type of setup. With this type of setup, what they are doing is they are magnifying the rangefinder. And they're magnifying the rangefinder so that the detail, you can get up much closer, and so you have a much better chance of accurately focusing that camera. So the Leica 2 had a separate viewfinder and separate rangefinder. Now, I've also just looked up the Leica 3 that followed it. Now, there are many variants of the Leica 3 between 1933 and 1960, but they all also had a separate rangefinder and separate viewfinder. Now, I did have a Leica 3 for a very short period of time. I found one of all places at a garage sale, and I bought it for under $10, but it was not functional. And rather than spend the money to have it fixed, and it is eminently fixable, I sold it as is, needing the repair. And I'm sure that somebody is using it today because it's not that difficult to get these things repaired. So I don't have a lot of experience, even though I did briefly own one of those. Now, this is a camera that was made 1933 through 1960. It went through very many variants, and there are some that are much rarer than others. And if you happen upon a Leica 3 in your grandmother's attic or someplace like that, do your research. That camera could be worth $200. That camera could be worth $7,000. So it's very much worth doing your research if you come across one of these. It's also very much something that you want to do research on if you decide you want to buy one of these. Many companies made Leica copies, and there were almost always copies of the Leica 3. And many companies made copies that were cosmetically almost identical, and they were probably functionally almost identical. And here's the reason why. At the end of World War II, German companies lost the rights to their intellectual property, so their patents went away. So these are products that can be copied legally and sold legally in many different countries around the world. The company that probably made the most Leica thread mount cameras in Japan was Canon. Now, their first one, the Canon 2, was an almost direct copy of the Leica 3. So if you come across one of those, they're almost direct copies. They're very good quality copies. Now, I want to talk about that. They're very good quality copies. So even though they're copies, that doesn't mean that they're necessarily lesser cameras. Canon sold a ton of these Leica 3 copies as the Canon 2. But as they matured as a camera company, they started to make improvements. And they made next the Canon P, or the Canon Populaire, which was a slightly less expensive version of the Canon 2. And it had some advantages, some more advancements. And then they did the Canon VT, and then the Canon 7. And the final Canon 7, the Canon 7S, even had a light meter built in, which was something that Leica didn't do until the 1980s. But Canon did it in the 1970s, or is the 1960s. I forget exactly when the Canon 7 came out. But they made those all the way into or close to the 80s. Even if they didn't make them all the way into the 80s, they made these very good Leica thread mount cameras. Similar to the Japanese cameras, post-war Leica 3 Soviet copies were definitely abundant. And again, they also started to evolve these cameras as they made them. So there are the Fed cameras and the Zorki cameras. Those two cameras are the Leica 3 copies. And there were hundreds of thousands probably, there were probably hundreds of thousands, if not over a million, of those Soviet copies of the Leica 3, and then the advancement of those cameras. There was another German company that was instrumental in the popularizing of the interchangeable lens rangefinder camera, and that was Zeiss. And they had a camera called Contax. It was made 1932 through 1960. It was copied after the war in a different way than the Leicas were copied. What happened was, at the end of World War II, the town that Zeiss was centered in was in the eastern part of Germany, and the eastern part of Germany was in the Russian zone, the Soviet zone. So the Soviet Union took over the Carl Zeiss and therefore the Contax production line. And in fact, they moved one of the factories from Germany to Kiev, and that was the origin of the Kiev brand name for cameras. There was still some production that was done in East Germany during this time. And then there was also a business that set up in West Germany using the same names. Now, they are difficult to figure out during the Soviet era, so really do your research into which Zeiss camera or which Zeiss lens you are looking at. Some of the identical lenses were produced both in West Germany and in East Germany by completely different companies based on designs that were pre-war. So it is really, you know, important to do that research specifically with Zeiss cameras. Zeiss, just like Leica, lost their patents at the end of World War II, but the only one who really took on that complex Contax mount with any sort of success was Nikon. And that was the Nikon S series. And the Nikon S series was made all throughout the 1950s and 60s. And then also in 2015, Nikon released again an anniversary series of those cameras. So there are some cameras that you'll find that will be Nikon S and in parentheses 2015. And that is certainly a highly desirable line of cameras there. Now, they are of very high quality pretty much anywhere where you get them, including the Kievs, as I understand it. I've never owned one, but they are very, very interesting cameras to find. Now, one of the advantages of having one of these Contax copies or a true Contax camera is that many Soviet lenses were made in both Leica thread mount and in Kiev / Contax mounts. The Kiev / Contax mounts are about half the price generally for the same type of glass. So that's something to think of when you start looking at expanding the lens line of your camera. Partially, there's a little bit of argument, but partially to combat the loss of the patents, Leica introduced a new mount in 1954. It was the Leica M mount. And it is a bayonet mount just like the Contax mount and pretty much every single lens reflex camera mount is a bayonet mount. And you know it's a bayonet mount, once again, if you push it in and then turn it and it locks into place. That is how you know it is a bayonet mount. It's a push in and a quarter turn usually. Whereas with a screw mount, you're spinning the lens all the way around several times. Now the first M mount cameras actually came in three flavors, and they're a little bit confusing to people. They were released essentially at the same time. The flagship camera was the M3, and that's really the first camera that became popular in the M mount line. And then the M2 was released pretty much at the same time, and it's a slightly stripped down version. And I actually have an M2, and when I come back from break, that little click sound, that little shutter sound that you hear, that's from my M2. Now, there was also an M1 that not only had no rangefinder, it also had no viewfinder. It was a camera that was designed for scientific use. So you would mount it to a microscope, you would mount it to a telescope, something like that. So the M1 has no rangefinder and it has no viewfinder. But you can put an external rangefinder or an external viewfinder on it and use it just like the M2 or M3. Early cameras started off, the M2s had a viewfinder that was almost what we would consider normal. It would give almost the exact same view that your eye would view. It was just a little bit wider. It was 92% of the view that your normal eye vision would give you. Now, what that would allow you to do is in that viewfinder are these little things called bright lines. Bright lines are white, essentially white lines in the viewfinder. It shows you what the edge of the frame will be depending on the lens that you had. Now, the M3 had viewfinders, I believe, this is what I believe, for a 35mm lens, for a 50mm lens, and it was either a 75mm lens. Those were the three bright lines that were within that viewfinder window. But that viewfinder window being 92% of the view that you would normally get, you can kind of see outside of that frame. And as you see outside of that frame, you can see things that are about to enter your frame. This is an absolute revelation. And in fact, the M2 had an 85% view lens, a 0.85 lens. And what that does is it allows you to see even more of the view. So you have a much better idea of what is coming into the lens, what is coming into the frame, and whether or not you can take your picture easily, and you can time things as they enter the frame by knowing that they're going to enter the frame before they appear in the frame. Now, this is one of the actual great advantages of a rangefinder over a single lens reflex. Now, a single lens reflex, you're only seeing what a lens sees. So you can't see anything outside. You can't predict what's coming into that lens unless you keep one eye open and one eye on the lens, which many photographers do. That's a very good way of photographing action sequences. If you're trying to time when that bird crosses your lens, then it's really good to have both eyes open. Or use one of these cameras that had a less than 100% viewfinder. Now, these early cameras, these three early Leicas had either a single stroke or a double stroke film advance. Now, if you think about a single stroke or a double stroke, what they're doing is they're advancing the frame either half a frame or a full frame. A single stroke will advance the film a full frame with every stroke. A double stroke will advance the film half a frame for every stroke. Now, the idea with that was film at that time could easily tear. And if you reduced the gearing, you know, if you're advancing it too fast, you could easily tear that film. So by reducing the gearing, they reduced that tearing possibility. So it was a very much an advance. The double stroke was an advance. And I've had other double stroke cameras, not Leicas that were double stroke. Mine is a single stroke. But it's very easy to get in the habit, and it's not a problem at all. Don't think of a double stroke Leica body as a lesser body. In fact, I think they go for a little bit more than single stroke bodies. But if you see an SS or a DS on a listing, that's what it's talking about. This Leica M3 body style, that's the basis of the camera. So the Leica M3 body style lasted from 1954 through, I don't know, 2010. I think the Leica M8 and M9 even look very much the same. They're in that same format with a couple of exceptions. There were two models, the Leica CL and the Leica M5, that deviated from that model. And we'll get to those in just a minute. The Leica M4 was almost identical to the Leica M5, but within the Leica M4 line, you had a choice of viewfinder magnification. So you could have I forget what they all are, but I believe you could get a 0.85, a 0.72, and a 0.58 viewfinder. So that means you could see a lot. And it also depends on whether you're using wide angle lenses more or you're using more normal lenses or telephoto lenses. That would define which viewfinder focusing level that you would want. Now, the M4 was very, very similar to the M3. It is slightly upgraded. I don't know the differences other than the M4 that's on the outside of the case. I think that a Leica M3 or a Leica M4 will work very similarly. In the 1980s, now I want to point out, up to this point, none of these Leicas nor the Contax cameras had light meters. Now, there were no light meters until the Leica M5 came in. The Leica M5 was introduced in 1971. In order to get light meter technology into that camera, they had to expand the body by quite a bit. And it uses a very strange stalk. It's a little thing that pops up when it's ready to meter the light, and then it lays down just before the image is taken. And I had a Leica M5 for a long time, and it's a very good camera, but it, I don't know whether it's twice the weight. It is very much heavier than the Leica M3, and it is much bigger. Now, it is a very, very, very nice camera. It's the black sheep of the family because of its size. Now, it had a, you know, very long rangefinder base. It is an advanced camera. It is a really nice camera, but unfortunately it went over like a lead balloon because it was bigger, it was heavier, and it was super expensive. So people just kept buying the M4, and Leica then said, well, let's force people to buy this. Let's discontinue the M4. Now, at the same time they were discontinuing the M4, they were building up a single lens reflex line of cameras. And that single lens reflex line of cameras, the first ones were, they were okay cameras.